Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
Yes, it is time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. Today, Tracy is hopefully finding out her responsibilities as Associate Minister for Education and is settling into her parliamentary routine. I talked to her to find out the specific method of testing that will replace national standards or simply be reinstated, as she explains, and her plans for Oranga Tamariki. How has Parliament been?
Actually, it's been a lot better now that we're back into a routine, for me anyway. So now we're back into sitting days and, you know, I get into the office at 7:30 in the morning, I leave the office at 10:30 at night. It feels just much better to be in that sort of a routine.
I don't know about you, but I'm getting a lot of press releases from Nikki Kaye, who really wants to know what is going on with national standards and what is going to replace it.
Well, it's relatively easy, and so you're not getting press releases from Nikki because she actually wants to know. It's because she's trying to create a sense of crisis among a parental body, right? Before national standards, there were always formative assessment that were then translated into sort of achievement outcomes for a student on your report card, right? So you went to school before there were national standards. Your parents got a report card in the middle of the year and at the end of the year at least. And during that year, they would also have been invited to a parent-teacher interview to discuss how you were getting on at school. None of that is changing. The only thing that's happening with this removal of national standards is that in 2009, this administrative model was placed over the top of everything else that schools were already doing, and they had to centrally report. So they had to pick up that information and send it to the Ministry of Education in a form that the ministry wanted it. And that was an administratively, it just stretched them from an administrative perspective. They also dictated what your report card would look like. Now, prior to that, schools were able to actually say, Lillian might be working at this particular level in English, but we can see that the next steps for her are this. Well, this government dictated that the report card had to show whether you were below, at, or above the standard. It's not like we haven't ever had another reporting system, and what we're doing is we're going back to it. We're removing the template so that it's not about being at, above, or below the standard. It's about you and where you are at with regard to the progressions in the New Zealand curriculum. And then it's also about not having to send all that administration away centrally at this stage to a government agency.
You've also said that parent-teacher interviews are a good way of finding out where your child is at, and you've said that there are leaflets, I think, sent out by the PPTA about what sort of questions you can ask. What are those questions?
Ultimately, at the end of the day, they are how is my child in the class? Are they participating in the class? Do they have peers that they work with? What are the next steps that I might be able to do at home? Like if my child is having difficulty with their times table, for example, what are some of the things I might be able to do at home to help them? And what are you going to be doing in class to help them? So those are the sort of, they're very simple questions, but they provide very simple answers and great clarity for a parent to say, well, we know Johnny's having difficulty with times tables, but I tell you what, we've got these flashcards. If you do the flashcards at home, then when we come to class, we'll reinforce that from lessons that we do inside class. And that's what education is always supposed to be. It's teamwork between parents and teachers.
And what if parents can't make it to those interviews?
Well, one of the things that schools have been doing for a long time is actually holding those interviews at 7 o'clock at night. So you can either come during the day, or one of the schools I know actually closed for a day so that parents were able to either come during the daytime or the teachers were there all the way through to 9 o'clock at night. They have quite good sort of digital booking systems now. Most schools, there's an app that can be downloaded that will do that. But also if you can't make that particular day or that particular time, you can make an appointment with a teacher at any time. You can contact the school and ask to make an appointment and come in and sit down at a time that is convenient with a teacher. They do it all the time.
Is this going to put more pressure on teachers?
This is what they used to do. This is actually the one-on-one conversations that teachers want to have with parents. This is what they have always wanted to do, but national standards squashed it. So what we're doing is we're going back to the one-on-one information that we had about every single child without the conversation just being about are they at, above or below the standard. This is about the holistic child. What does this child feel passionate about and how can we use their passion and their interest to help them improve their English?
All right, so the government has announced there will be an inquiry into abuse in state care. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Not a lot more. What I've had is I've had ministerial meetings around, like with Carmel Cepelloni, who has the Minister for Social Development, and myself and our teams of officials to work through the what would the structure of the inquiry be. So there's several choices. There's a Royal Commission inquiry, there's a ministerial inquiry, there's a public inquiry. Each of those things have slightly different parameters. What would the scope of it be? And before we set that, we're actually going out to around 20 organisations, particularly Māori and some Pacifica organisations, to ask them, what do you think the scope should be? And then we intend to take a cabinet paper to cabinet, I think it's early December, so that we can get cabinet sign-off on the scope, the type of inquiry, and then we can go forward to announce these are the people who are going to run it. This is what it's going to be. So right now, we're still in that conversation stage before we take the cabinet paper through in December.
Why do you think this hasn't been a priority before now?
Well, I think, I can only assume because I wasn't in the previous government, and I've seen some some comments by the Honourable Ann Tolley, who said that they didn't feel, well, they wanted to do it on a one-on-one basis. If I had to make an assumption, it's because the fear that the state has about what's going to actually come out and the size of it and the scope of it. So, you have to be brave sometimes. We have to uncover, we have to have out in the public domain, and this is not going to be pleasant. I have no doubt that this is not going to be pleasant for the state or for the people that are actually going to be giving their testimony. But we have to uncover the truth, so that these people can be validated, so they are finally believed. These are people who haven't been believed all through their childhood. We need to give them the fact that we believe you. This happened. We believe you.
There's obviously in other colonial countries, yeah. Australia, for example, the stolen generation. Do you think that this is our own stolen generation and up until now there's been a denial of it actually happening?
I think that's a really interesting comment, and I don't have a view. I haven't set on a particular view. But what we know is that during the particular time frame that the Never Again campaign focuses on, 1950s to 1990s, there is no doubt that overwhelmingly the numbers were Māori children that were uplifted. So I'm not going to actually make that specific statement that you made, but there's no denying the demographic that's been mostly affected.
And you've said that there needs to be an attitude and culture change in how the department cares for those children. What does that look like?
Well, actually, I think what I have found, because remember we're talking about a completely different organisation now with Aranga Tamariki, and I would have to say, which only has been in existence for 6-7 months, that the pathway that Aranga Tamariki is on is I'm really, really excited and confident that the pathway they're on is the right one to change the way we have treated children who have to be removed from their families or who have to be supported by the state or have been who are being a part of the youth justice system. It's a long way to go, but the vision is a really good one. The voice of the child is finally being heard, and we need a lot more of that voice inside what we're doing, and that's why I think the voice Whakaranga Mai being set up has been really powerful. But I honestly believe that Aranga Tamariki, the way it's been set up, and strangely enough, you've got to give credit to Ann Tolley for that as well, it's the right direction. It's heading in the right direction. I have the responsibility to make sure that they don't get diverted from that.
So you think that attitude and cultural change has occurred?
No, not yet. I believe that at the top of the chain, like Grania West and the others that are at the top of Aranga Tamariki, who are working hard to change the culture all the way down to the social worker working with the particular child. that's yet to happen. That's going to take time to happen. But don't get me wrong either. The social workers that are on the street working with those individual young people, their motivation is absolutely pure. There's nobody there, I don't believe, that doesn't want to do right by the young person. It's just the difference of actually, rather than the adults deciding what is best for the young person, we need to listen to the young person at the same time and talk with them about what is possible for them and how can we try and, like, keeping them close to their siblings. Do you know what I mean? Things like that.
There has been criticism, particularly from Māori spokespeople, around some of the changes in that, where there is no longer a provision to put Māori children with whānau. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, see, that's interesting because, and what you're talking about is the whānau first rule, and I guess my statement is it's always whānau first, except not at all cost. Now, my family is, my mother was whānau'd by Maud Wahi of Ngāti Kahanunu. So, that was because there was a person, my mother was abandoned by her mother, her father was away, and so my nanny Maud took in my mother and her older brother. That had nothing to do with their culture or their race. But first of all, people need to understand that whānau is wider than just family, okay? It's not a direct translation from what Europeans think is family. It's huge. So anywhere down that line, and anybody who is, say, a godparent or whatever, or somehow connected to that family who has goodwill, is considered whānau. I personally think that there's been, this argument has been around a narrow concept of immediate family, and so I'm hoping that I can have wider conversations about what whānau actually means and alleviate some of the concerns that have been put out there by Māoridom.
I think that's a really important point, but don't those Māori spokespeople, wouldn't they have a fair understanding of that concept? And if you're going to commit to putting them within whānau, given that that is, the meaning of that is the wider conception, right? Do you make that commitment?
I commit to putting the children in the safest place for the children, okay? Now, I want to just expand on this. The suggestion is, by those particular people, that whānau is only Māori. Now, I've got grandparents raising grandchildren who are raising their Māori grandchildren. Are they whānau because they're Pākehā? Do you see what I mean? This is the interesting conversation, is that the suggestion is that whānau is only Māori, and it's not. Not in my family, not in many families. So if there's two sets of grandparents and one is Pākehā and one is Māori, and the Pākehā grandparents are able to look after the child, is the suggestion that they shouldn't because they're not Māori? And yet they are whānau.
So yep. I looked at some of your tweets, actually. You had a funny little tweet about, was it MP Michael Woodhouse mansplaining you? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Oh, no, it was just he stood up and he said, it was around the parental leave bill, and let's get real, the Nats were extending the committee stage to make sure that we didn't pass it last night. So that's fine. It's nice to see them have to do the work after 9 years of watching us have to do the work. But really, it was their comment about, me being naive. It's one of those things. Here's a challenge. Somebody go through the Hansards for the last 6 years and find a woman who has called a man naive. It's one of those little phrases that that you get. And that's why I tweeted out that it was mansplaining. I can hear all the people now going nuts about, Yes, it's a gender bias comment that I'm making. You're absolutely right.
But it is almost gendered in terms of stereotypical attitudes towards women and not knowing things, and can be seen as condescending.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's all I'm saying is if people, those that might take exception to what I just said, that Michael was mansplaining, and he won't, look, he wasn't doing it deliberately, but I challenge people, go back, look in the last 6 years, find me a single woman who has called a man naive in the Hansard in that house.
Not a big deal, but something that we can be making a difference around, I think.
Let's call it out. I mean, he needs to be aware of it. I mean, if he had a look at it, it doesn't affect me, don't get me wrong, but if he actually went and had a look and they realised some of the words that they use, that they don't use the words to male colleagues, but they use the words to women, I think it's just a really interesting little sort of unconscious bias, to be frank.
All right. Well, thank you for talking with us again.
All right, Lynn. Take care.
Have a good day.
Bye.
See ya. J Just following on from the Oranga Tamariki discussion, I had wanted to go into more detail with Tracy on the whānau first provision. Maybe we can talk about it a bit more next week. The concerns that I was talking about that have been raised are particularly regarding the need for Māori children to be placed with those they whakapapa to ensure they have access to that knowledge specific to te ao Māori and to their particular iwi. There's evidence that Māori children who are not placed in these environments can be disadvantaged in many ways. Most definitely, there need to be discussions around what whānau constitutes generally in this country, but given it is a Māori word, there should be that consultation with Māori that is required by the treaty. There is also the criticism of the inability to guarantee self-determination of Māori for the well-being of Māori children, and instead it being up to a state institution that mostly takes the advice of Pākehā organisations that are seen as the preferred providers. There's been a number of recommendations to set up strategic partnerships with iwi and Māori organisations, as well as have an inquiry independent of the government. This will certainly be something to follow as the new government takes up the issues surrounding Oranga Tamariki.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire.